Hello and welcome to your talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill and this is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday the 24th of July 2021. I do hope you're all well and staying safe. The music this week is another track from guitarist Jeremy North, whose piece Call Me Saturday I played last month. His interesting technique of overdubbing his own guitar parts is particularly effective on Summer Rain, the piece I'm playing this week. He's kindly given permission for us to use this in our programme, and I will, of course, play it in full at the end. This week, as usual, we have the news stories and radio listings, and then a rundown of television programmes that offer audio description. Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes are next, and then we have a couple of articles from the current edition of Hearts Life magazine. The first is an account by cyclist and BBC journalist Steve Silk of his journey by bike up the Great North Road. Traversed by royals, rebels and highwaymen, it was once the backbone of Britain, and the author cycled its length to discover its treasures and history. We then have a piece with the intriguing title of Poet's Corner, a country garden near Wheathampstead where poetry and gardening come together. This will be followed by the third in the series of items warning of scams recorded by HCC Trading Standards Officer Darren Ward. This one concerns energy-saving scams. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Sarah, Bob, Caroline and Elaine.
Hello, I'm Caroline. And my first story this week is entitled St Albans Barber and Landlord Hit by COVID Closures Due to Pingdemic. The controversial relaxation of lockdown restrictions has been accompanied by a so-called Pingdemic, as people are forced to self-isolate because the NHS Track and Trace app said they have been in close contact with someone with COVID. In St Albans, several businesses have temporarily closed their doors due to a lack of available staff, leaving them once again feeling the financial impact of the virus. Sam Campagna, owner of Alternative Barbering Company on George Street, St Albans, said he has temporarily closed his salon after two of his staff came into contact with positive COVID cases. Because his team worked with those colleagues up to 3 days before the positive test, he has had to shut the entire business. He is now urging other businesses to stay COVID safe despite the easing of lockdown restrictions on Monday. Sam said although he respects the pandemic regulations and will always act in the best interest of his staff and clients, he fears that many others are not doing the same. The father of two said, "The main gripe I have is that I want to be doing my job. We feel like we are being punished for doing the right thing. Some barbers are not closing when they get the messages. Some are using social media to promote that they are against the vaccine. And there is one where nobody has worn masks through the entirety of the pandemic. What I care about is that we are all singing from the same hymn sheet, and I don't think we are. As the industry has shown, all the responsible places are now continuing to wear masks, even now. My clients appreciate honesty, and I know it is going to be easier after August the 16th. From this date, people in England who come into contact with a COVID sufferer will no longer have to self-isolate for up to 10 days. Sam said that now businesses are not really getting any help from the government except furlough at 70%. He added, "I really feel that the District Council doesn't do enough from a health and safety point of view. Until our industry is regulated, we are going to come up against these irregularities in practice." Joe Tavernier, Head of Community Services at St Albans District Council, said, "COVID support officers have visited many barber shops and hairdressers over the last year, both through the current contract and previously, as a result of complaints received, where necessary, followed up by environmental health officer visits. In addition, we have issued warnings and in one case a fixed penalty notice of £1,000 on a barbershop business." Meanwhile, England's oldest pub, Ye Olde Fighting Cocks, missed out on the start of the summer heatwave after being forced to close last week after staff were pinged by Track and Trace. Landlord, Christo Tofali, said on Friday, "Sadly, we had to close for 10 days, including this beautiful weekend, due to Track and Trace sending all our staff home to isolate. Everyone is safe and well. We're just gutted at the timing. What a banger of a weekend it would have been after all of the rain. We have one of the best and biggest beer gardens around. It's 30-odd degrees today in the height of summer when we really need to take it. And it's closed. The solution the government has ended up passing on to all of us is nothing less than abject failure. We currently don't even have the ability to open and serve the little economy we do have left to come back to. Independent hospitality will suffer to an extent that it will be decimated. Winter is on its way, and if history teaches anything, and we have enough of it in St Albans to go by, I see a revolt on its way. He added on Monday, "This is just going to keep happening. We just need to be able to open and stay open, which is impossible. We keep paying the same set-up and set-down costs, and at some point it's going to snap." If anyone has concerns about how a business is operating under COVID, they can contact St Albans District Council's Environmental Health Team at environmental@stalbans.gov.uk. And this article has a picture of ye olde fighting cocks in all its glory, and also a picture of Sam Campagna, the hairdresser, doing a fantastic alternative haircut on a young girl.
Hello, I'm Sarah. Keep unaffordable Simmons Hyde scheme out of the local plan, plea. The chair of Save Simmons Hyde Group has called on neighbouring councillors to meet their previous commitments and leave the area out of the local plan. The planning inspector has enabled Welwyn Hatfield Borough Council to remove Simmons Hyde from its plan by saying that the site is a judgment call for the council to make. However, he also said he was satisfied that a development of 1,500 or more dwellings could be supported in the location. The council has to build 15,200 homes in the borough following the inspector's updated, objectively assessed housing need. And he has also identified sites suitable for around 17,000 homes, meaning that in theory there is room to eliminate a Simmons Hyde development from the local plan. Councillors and planners have described Simmons Hyde as a location of last resort, to be used if other more suitable locations couldn't be found. This was reiterated by councillors from all sides when WHBC voted to withdraw Simmons Hyde from the plan in January 2020 and confirmed that position later in the year. Chair of Save Simmons Hyde, John Gardner, believes that a development on the site would mean losing valuable green space for houses at prices that locals could afford. He said, "We've all learnt over the last year and a half how much we need our green spaces. Over half of the houses proposed will be on Greenbelt. We're calling on WHBC and recently elected councillors to meet their previous commitments and save Simmons Hyde." It is argued by the government and developers that more houses are necessary to make them more affordable. But affordable in planning speak means 80% of the local market price. It doesn't mean that most Welwyn Hatfield residents could afford them. Bigger plots almost always mean higher house prices. Simmons Hyde is one of the sites with lowest housing density, so it will be one of the more expensive locations. The developer's description was as an attractive location as St Albans or Harpenden. The group also rejects the idea of building more houses will make the site more sustainable. The argument is that it might make the bus service economically viable, as many as 10% of the journeys would be made by bus. "We're deeply sceptical," said John. "Even if it were true, over 60% of all journeys would still be by car." WHBC has until September the 17th to submit a new selection of sites.
Hello, this is Bob here. Team of cyclists pedal 300 miles to Newcastle to raise £33,000 for charity. A team of determined cyclists from two local construction firms completed a 300-plus mile cycle to Newcastle and raised over £33,000 for the mental health charity Mind. The team of 14 men from Boom Construction and TRAC Construction Limited set off from their HQ at Rose Farm, Chiswell Green, for an epic 3-day journey to the north. The first leg of their journey saw them cycling 90 miles to Leicester. Then the next day they completed 110 miles to Leeds, before finishing the final 106 miles to Newcastle on the third day. They decided to ride for Mind, as this is a charity close to their hearts, and supporting its work will help people of all ages affected by the pandemic. The team was led by Rob Ashman, who organised the cycle event, and he was joined by managing directors Oliver Clegg and Stephen Toga, plus dedicated employees Oscar Parrish, Stuart Abington, Craig Baker, Simon Cope, Adam Clegg, David O'Sullivan, James Brophy and Brian O'Malley. Supporting the team were Dan Reed, Ben Orbital and Damien Levy. Rob said, "The past 15 months has been an extremely mentally challenging time for everyone, with the restrictions that COVID has forced upon us. At the start of 2021, we decided to raise money for Mind, who have been providing fantastic support throughout this time. The 300-mile ride pushed all cyclists physically and mentally to the limit, and we're delighted to have now raised over £33,000, with our original target being £25,000. The team spent around 7 hours on the saddle each day, with support being provided by 3 vans assisting with mechanical failures, hydration, and making sure everyone was fed along the way. Temperatures soared over the trip, which didn't help with the 5,000 metres of elevation accomplished over the duration of the ride. The feedback from everyone was overwhelming, and we are pleased to say that we will be arranging another much bigger cycle event next year." And there's a tag at the end of the article that says their initial target was to raise £25,000, but so far the team has raised a staggering £33,185. And there's a great photograph of the charity cyclists from Boom Construction and TRAC Construction in Chiswell Green, St Albans, with a number of the cyclists in there with their bikes and cycling gear.
Hello, my name is Elaine, and the first article I'm going to read for you today is about a heroic Harpenden duo who are all fired up for a charity marathon. Mum and son, Jane and Connor Smith, will walk 26.2 miles on September the 4th in support of the Firefighters charity. They were inspired to take part in the event because Jane's partner is a firefighter. The charity offers specialist life support for members of the UK Fire Services community, empowering individuals to achieve mental, physical and social well-being throughout their lives. It provides independent, personalised support to thousands of people each year. They exist to support all fire and rescue services personnel, whatever their role in the service. Jane said, "We were originally planning to do this last year, but obviously it didn't happen. Since we signed up in 2019, we have walked hundreds of miles in training and are feeling more than ready. We are aiming to raise a minimum of £1,000.
This next article is about how some very inspiring teachers have used COVID as a way to enhance our young children's learning. Artifacts from a year of living in the shadow of coronavirus have been buried in a time capsule at a Harpenden school. Roundwood Primary School in the town wanted to mark the historical significance of the last year for the children, which has had such an impact on their lives. Each class put something into the time capsule to represent the last year. And one child from each class watched as the box was buried and explained what they had put in and why. Artifacts included photos of the school as it is now, a rainbow of hands, a sparkly hand sanitizer, a sculpture made from disposable face masks, a Lego house, scrapbooks of photos and a memory stick filled with 30-second clips about lockdown experiences. Of course, there was also a copy of the day's paper, the Hearts Advertiser. The time capsule will be dug up in 2027, when the current reception class will be in Year 6. And accompanying this is a photo of all the children sitting round chatting about the time capsule and explaining what they've done to the Harpenden Mayor, Councillor Paul Cousin.
Critical workers' thanks motion is rejected by district councillors. A motion calling for a special thank you to critical workers who risk their lives during a pandemic has been rejected by a majority of district councillors. Conservatives Councillor Mary Maynard and Councillor Julian Daly proposed recognising the dedication, self-sacrifice, skill and hard work of frontline workers by allowing a 50% discount on season parking permits or by waiving the green waste charge for the rest of this financial year. The Lib Dem administration condemned the move as breathtaking Tory hypocrisy. Council leader, Councillor Chris White, said that the party that gave the NHS a pay cut in the middle of the COVID epidemic should pretend it cares about care workers is literally sickening. It is increasingly apparent that the local Conservatives aren't a serious political party and are intent on wasting time of local people and of this council and its officers with their shameless political posturing. The Lib Dems proposed an amendment, which included honouring hospitality food heroes, a special Mayor's Pride Award in honour of frontline workers and community champions, and demanding full financial compensation for the costs of COVID from the government. Councillor Mary Maynard said in her speech rejecting the amendment, "Many of the frontline workers Julian and I wish to thank in our motion are low paid. They will understand this sentiment and would echo it to you if they were here tonight. Waiving the green waste charge or giving a 50% discount on season parking tickets would mean a lot to them. For many of the people here tonight, the affluent middle class, it doesn't mean much. But for frontline workers, it often means a lot. Sadly, we cannot support the Liberal Democrat amendment. It shows no care for the people we are here to serve and who served us so well. It is merely a misguided and ill-informed attack on the government and a watering down of the Conservative motion so that the people we want to thank get nothing, no tangible benefit at all, which means no real thanks. Giving their leadership teams an award or a party means nothing to them. It's words, not action. In a break with tradition, the Lib Dems used the usually non-partisan mayor to vote against the motion."
Fraud probe. A fraud probe is underway involving the allocation of St Albans District Council building contracts and the misuse of public sector funds. Three people have been arrested as part of a National Investigation Service, that's NATIS, investigation into fraud, bribery and money laundering, totalling £2.5 million of public sector funds. The arrests of three men, aged 47, 51 and 55, took place at various locations in Harpenden and Ruislip on July the 9th. One of the men was arrested for fraud by abuse of position, bribery and money laundering, and the other suspects for bribery and money laundering. Following property searches and interviews, all three have been released under investigation, while inquiries continue. Amanda Foley, Chief Executive at St Albans and District Council, said, "We called the police in to investigate when our internal processes picked up a potential issue of concern to our internal audit team that they felt merited further investigation. We then worked closely with the National Investigation Service, giving them our full cooperation. The Hearts Ad believes the investigation follows work carried out by SADC's internal audit team that resulted in a referral to the police in their January 2020 anti-fraud report. The NATIS probe did not reveal evidence that there had been direct theft of public sector monies. It did reveal a pattern of conflicts of interest, one-sided contracts and negligent reporting that resulted in a council employee having unfettered discretion to award four companies substantial sums of public sector funds for services. Public sector employees cannot make, participate in making, or in any way attempt to use their official position to influence a governmental decision in which they knowingly have a financial interest." Michael Dineen, Deputy Director Head of Crime Operations at the NATIS, said, "Those employed in the public sector owe a duty to act with transparency and diligently in exercising oversight over the operations to the public authority they serve. The procurement process exists to economically benefit local communities, not the civil servants managing them.
And here are the profiles of seven Team GB Olympians from our area who have represented Team GB at the Olympics, including a former world record holder and one of cycling's all-time greats. Victoria Pendleton was born in Stockfold and raised in Hitchin. Victoria Pendleton has gone down as one of the greatest cyclists in British history, with her gold medal wins at the 2008 and 2012 Olympics her crowning achievement. At the Beijing Games, Pendleton won silver in the women's keirin before going on to take gold in the sprint race. 4 years later, in London, she finally won gold in keirin. The North Harts racer would then set a new Olympic record of 10.724 seconds in the qualifiers of the sprint, before going on to win silver in the event. A race that turned out to be her last before retirement, as she cemented her legacy as one of cycling's greatest. And there's a wonderful picture of Victoria holding up the flag, looking so proud.
Ellie Watton and Hannah McLeod, St Albans. Former St Albans Hockey Club players Ellie Watton and Hannah McLeod were part of the 2016 Olympic gold medal winning side alongside Helen Richardson Walsh. McLeod was also part of the side that won bronze at London 2012, but the pair played key roles in the 2016 triumph before retiring from the game in 2018. McLeod was also awarded an MBE in 2017 for her services to hockey. This article is accompanied by an action photo of Ellie Watton and also a photo of Hannah McLeod and Australia's Mariah Williams during a match between Great Britain and Australia.
Jodie Williams, Welwyn Garden City. Born in Welwyn Garden City and a former student of Potter's Bar's Dame Alice Owens School, Jodie Williams is looking to put her London 2012 and Rio 2016 heartbreak behind her in Tokyo. After a string of injuries, sprinter Williams failed to secure her Team GB place in the 100 metres. But the then 18-year-old was determined to come back stronger. "I just had so much going on and my body just started to break down," she said. "If someone had asked me before what my worst setback was, I would have said coming second at the World Juniors, but this was a proper setback. That was my first real setback year. It was hard, as I'd not been used to dealing with setbacks before. It was tough to sit on the bench and watch it, to see other people competing and think, I could have been there at the home of the Olympics. But then I told myself, I'm 18 and there's hopefully plenty more Olympics ahead of me. It wasn't nice sitting at home, and it took me a while to get over that." Despite winning silver in the European and Commonwealth 200 metres races, she nearly quit athletics twice before Rio 2016, where she failed to qualify for the final. Williams is back in Team GB squad for this summer's games, and this time is a 400 metres runner.
Helen Richardson Walsh, Hitchin. Having won bronze at the London 2012 Games, Hitchin-born Helen Richardson Walsh played a key role as Team GB won their first ever gold in women's hockey at the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. The team got off to the best possible start, winning all five of their group games to qualify for the quarterfinals. Spain were seen off in a 3-1 victory, followed by a 3-0 win against New Zealand in the last four to secure their final spot, with Richardson Walsh scoring in both games. Up against a much-fancied Netherlands side in the gold medal match, the game went to penalties after a 3-3 draw. Maddie Hinch's goalkeeping heroics saw her save all four Dutch penalties, with Richardson Walsh and Holly Webb scoring as the team won gold and made history. Speaking after the final, Richardson Walsh said, "It's difficult to put into words what this means. 17 years ago, when I started my career, we were so far off this. It has taken so much hard work, and it means absolutely everything." And there's a picture Great Britain's Helen Richardson Walsh celebrates scoring their second goal during the pool match between Argentina and Great Britain.
Tommy Hampson, Stevenage and St Albans. Ahead of the 1932 Olympics in Los Angeles, Tommy Hampson was considered one of the world's leading 800-metre runners. But just 2 years earlier, he had been a teacher at St Albans School. In a hard-fought race at the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, Hampson's late charge for the finish saw him overtake Canadian runner Alex Wilson to secure the gold medal with a new world and Olympic record time of 1 minute 49.7 seconds. It wasn't the only Olympic medal he won in 1932, as he secured silver in the 4 by 400 metres relay team, coming second behind the United States. Hampson would retire from athletics later that year before leaving his teaching job to join the Royal Air Force, staying in the service until after the Second World War. He moved to Stevenage in 1954, but sadly passed away in 1965 at the age of 57. He is buried at the Church of St Mary, where he was warden before his death, while Hampson Park is named in his honour, and there's a wonderful old picture here, a black and white picture, showing Tommy Hampson on the podium with his medal in 1932, and he's just so proud.
Daniel Goodfellow, Melbourne. From Meldrith and a student at Melbourne Village College from 2008 to 2013, diver Daniel Goodfellow trained at Cambridge Dive Team and Plymouth Dive Club as a youngster, before earning a Team GB spot for the 2016 Rio Olympics. Teaming up with London 2012 bronze medalist Tom Daly for the 10-metre synchro, Goodfellow and his partner had their eyes on the medal places. Sitting in fifth place ahead of their fifth dive, a score of 92.13 shot them up to third, but they still had work to do to secure their place on the podium. Needing a score of 84 on their final dive to jump back above the German pair, the British duo waited anxiously before leaping into the pool in celebration when the score of 89.64 came up as they won bronze. Goodfellow will be looking to win another medal in Tokyo, this time in the 3-metre synchro when he teams up with Jack Laffer. And there's a photo of Tom Daly and Daniel Goodfellow holding up their bronze medals while standing on the podium in their Team GB tracksuits, looking very pleased with themselves, as well they should.
Harpenden's first sustainable market is a scorching success. More than 1,200 people came out on the hottest day of the year so far to enjoy Harpenden's first ever sustainable market, offering local plastic-free and eco-friendly products and gifts, vegan food and environmental groups. The Sunday market was organised by the environmental charity Sustainable St Albans in partnership with Harpenden Town Council. Harpenden Town Mayor Councillor Paul Cousin, who opened the market, said, "The first sustainable market in Harpenden was a great success and I enjoyed talking to the stallholders. I think it was a terrific opportunity for Harpenden-based eco-friendly businesses who had a stall on the day, and I hope that we can work towards future sustainable markets in the town." Leslie Flowers from Sustainable St Albans said, "There were nearly 40 stallholders, and we were especially pleased to welcome Harpenden-based eco-businesses, as well as district-wide environmental groups such as Plastic Free Harpenden and Wilder St Albans. Thank you to all the volunteers from Harpenden Lions and Sustainable St Albans who helped to make this a successful, enjoyable and safe event." Local eco groups highlighted plastic-free products, including Plastic-Free Harpenden displaying a local recycling map and Hearts Waste Aware promoting reusable nappies and plastic-free period wear. Plastic-free businesses included Wrap and Pack, who make biodegradable tableware and containers made from sugarcane pulp and cornstarch. Sumit Bhatia, Harpenden resident and owner of Wrap and Pack, said, "It's been a brilliant opportunity to take part in the market and to be able to display our products locally to people who believe in a plastic-free future. My Refill Life, a home refill delivery service for household cleaning products, also had a stall. Company founder and Harpenden resident Viviana Cruz Morrison said, "We're really passionate about helping our community to reduce single-use plastic, and it was great to meet so many local residents who are keen to try our service and to cut their plastic use at home." Other Harpenden-based stallholders taking part included family-run Twist Teas, Third Wave, which make bags from upcycled sails, Balmy, which are sustainable self-care products, Handmade in Harpenden with vegan-friendly beauty products, Tropic Skincare, and, would you believe it, gifts from handcraft salvage wood. This article was accompanied by some lovely pictures, including one of Harpenden Town Mayor Councillor Paul Cousin cutting the bunting to open the market. It also had some lovely pictures of the gazebo-style market stalls on the grass, with everyone attending looking hot and summery in sunglasses and sundresses and shorts.
Harpenden African Charity backs patron MP Afolani. A Harpenden charity which fundraises to provide education, health, clean water and economic development to slum communities in Uganda has given its full backing to the town's MP despite him voting in favour of cutting foreign aid. MPs voted to cut the foreign aid budget by £4 billion, a reduction from 0.7% to 0.5% of our country's GDP, in a narrow Commons vote which saw 24 Conservative MPs rebelling against the government. Chancellor Rishi Sunak told concerned MPs that the cut would only be temporary until Britain has begun to recover from the economic woes of the pandemic. Harpenden MP Bim Afolami, who voted in favour of the cut, is the patron of Harpenden Spotlight on Africa, a development charity striving to lift a slum community in Mbale out of extreme poverty. On his website, he describes himself as being extremely proud to be the charity's patron, adding, "I had the pleasure of visiting this community in rural Uganda and seeing firsthand the impressive impact that this local charity has." Following the vote on cutting foreign aid, Mr. Afolami told the Hearts ad, "This vote was extremely difficult. The UK's contributions to overseas aid have surpassed that of all major economies, with the 0.7% GDP commitment enshrined in law by a previous Conservative government. This temporary reduction in overseas aid spending to 0.5% is, of course, due to an understandable review of our fiscal responsibilities following the pandemic, and the need to find a balance that enables us to support the most vulnerable, both at home and abroad. We have a responsibility to our citizens to ensure that national debt levels come under control as quickly as possible, which will strengthen our economy and enable the UK to renew its commitment of 0.7% as swiftly as we can." The Chancellor has promised those of us who voted for this temporary measure that he will identify how we can improve the targeting of our aid spending to make our contributions go further. "I have emphasised to the government, both publicly and privately, the importance of ensuring that funding remains available for small, high-impact charities." Dr. Bethan Rees, Chair of Harpenden Spotlight on Africa, gave the MP their full support despite the vote. "Bim has been a tireless campaigner for our charity ever since he became our MP and patron, and has even taken the time to visit our projects in Uganda personally. He has a true heart for development in Africa and is one of our strongest fundraisers locally. The cut in foreign aid is a national political issue which is hugely complicated due to the COVID-19 pandemic." Harpenden resident and political activist Richard Scott said, "It came as no surprise to anyone who has followed the voting record of Bim Afolami to see him break his 2019 election manifesto commitment and vote with the government to reduce UK foreign aid from 0.7% to 0.5% of GDP. In addition, his vote was also a public and flagrant betrayal of Harpenden Spotlight on Africa, a highly regarded local charity who trusted Mr. Afolami as one of their patrons. Mr. Afolami claimed in the Commons that this decision was one of competing political choices. What nonsense. The government has clearly found money throughout the pandemic to award large government contracts to companies connected to Conservative Party donors and officials. Perhaps if the countries and charities benefiting from UK aid had been wise enough earlier to donate to the Conservative Party, this cut would never have been introduced. However, his decision to put his career and party interests first, yet again, should leave no one in Hitchin and Harpenden in any doubt where his loyalties truly lie. The next general election cannot come quickly enough. And there are some photographs accompanying the article. One is a picture of Bim Afolami ahead of the general election in 2019, talking about his priorities. There's a picture of a Harpenden spotlight on Africa immunisation clinic in Uganda. And then there's a great picture of about 20 plus children in Uganda holding up signs saying, "Thank you, Harpenden."
Here's why the family court system is failing. Divorced mother of three, Mary Smith, looks at the legal, emotional and mental minefields of the family court system and why something needs to change. I use a pseudonym to protect my identity, not from thugs or criminals, as you may be thinking, nor from my abuser. Yes, I have an abuser. It is to keep me safe from the very people who are supposed to protect me, our judges. If you go through family court proceedings, you are not allowed to share information about what happens in court, auspiciously to protect the identity of the children. However, as we know from other areas of life, a lack of transparency means any opportunity for scrutiny also disappears. As a result, the very baseline of our democracy vanishes, and with this, very often, any common sense. I hear of mums who are forced by the judge to return to the family home where they faced abuse for years, or who lose custody of their children because they spoke about the violence they've endured. Without this transparency, nobody can be in any way certain that what is happening in our courts bears any resemblance to justice. I chose a very nondescript name to reflect how painfully common the issues I face with the family court are. Whenever I share them with friends or neighbours, or through my social network support sites, I hear other stories very similar to mine, and often much worse. An application to the family court costs £255. This is not that much money, and since it is possible to attend court without a solicitor, it makes it pretty much accessible to everyone. Up to here, this is good news, of course. As a parent, nothing should stand in your way when trying to make things right for your children. But what if this is used by the wrong hands? What if someone keeps taking you back to court with the only intention being to make your life hell? It'd be the perfect weapon to control you, wouldn't it? Your life would get placed on hold. You wouldn't be able to make any plans, as you wouldn't know when you'll have the kids. You'll live in constant fear that your children could be taken away from you. You'd probably spend all your savings, most likely would get into debt to obtain legal advice, would possibly quit your job or reduce your hours and go on to benefits to give you enough time to prepare for the hearings. In these circumstances, it becomes very hard to focus on normality, like looking after your children, paying the bills, doing your job, having fun. What's that? At the hearing, your abilities as a mother, your true essence as a person, will be questioned again and again, and you'll be pulled apart every single time. A proper roller coaster of anxiety and stress of which you have no control. A perfect form of abuse. You probably imagine, like most people, that once the divorce is finalised and there's an order in place, everyone can move on and carry on with their life. Or that there would be some sort of filter by the court not to allow this type of nonsense. Ultimately, this is costing the taxpayer an absolute fortune that could be spent in putting in place a proper system that works. Let's face it, £255 doesn't even cover the price of processing your application by the clerk, let alone the wages of the judges who may end up dealing with it. It is not only that this is happening right in front of the eyes of the court system, but what is especially most concerning is that this system itself is enabling it to the point that it's been defined as state-sanctioned abuse. Surely, it is very easy to see when someone is abusing the system and constantly taking their ex back to court for no reason, or deliberately forcing them to make the same application again and again without good justification. You hear of mothers who, just a couple of months after an order has been issued, are taken back to court without any justification other than, "I changed my mind." Mums who live in misery until their children turn 18. How long will this abuse continue to take place?
New Children's Centre opens in the heart of St Albans. Ensuring every local child receives the best start in life is the impetus of St Albans' new state-of-the-art Children's Centre. The new facility, which opened at the Civic Centre at the start of the month, is a result of a collaboration between Hertfordshire Community NHS Trust, HCT, St Albans District Council and other local organisations striving to provide the best possible health and wellbeing care to the next generation. HCT services that have moved into the centre include children's speech and language therapy, children's physiotherapy, children's occupational therapy, community paediatrics, children's eye service, PALMS, P-A-L-M-S, for Positive Behaviour, Autism and Learning Disability and Mental Health Service, and Children's Nursing Services. HCT Chief Executive Elliot Howard-Jones said, "We share an ambition of wanting every local child to receive the health and wellbeing care that they need to have the best start in life. I'd like to thank everyone involved for their hard work and tenacity that's meant we've opened our doors on schedule despite unexpected challenges brought on by the global pandemic. The specialist services provided here are playing a crucial part in helping our children, young people and their families get back on track after such a tumultuous year." Councillor Robert Donald, Chair of the District's Health and Wellbeing Partnership, said, "I've been campaigning for many years for our offices to become a one-stop service and help advice centre for the district. It's great to see that vision come into effect." London Coney resident Sithi Nazima, mum of five-year-old Arbis, said, "The location in the Civic Centre is so convenient. I only have to get one bus now instead of two for our appointments. And when we get off the bus, it's right there. I like how the building's been designed to have lots of space and there's nice touches like the play area. It feels welcoming. Our appointment was great. I'm pleased Arbis is able to have his eyes checked regularly." Hazel Armstrong, mum of Max, too, from Harpenden, added, "I love the layout here. It's really clear where to go. The play area's a great idea and I like that there's lots of space in the waiting area. The service we've had has been wonderful. We've felt so supported."
Pub Raffle raises more than £1,000 for charity. A St Albans charity has received a donation from the proceeds of a pub raffle. The Ollie Foundation, which provides training on suicide awareness, received £1,007, which was raised by the White Swan Pub after it held a raffle to win a giant teddy named Ollie. The pub was inspired to donate the money to the charity after its owners saw an Instagram post from St Albans MP Daisy Cooper, in which she spoke about launching her urgent Christmas appeal to help sixth formers and students with mental health support. Founder of the Ollie Foundation, Stuart Falconer, said, "I always get blown away when things like this happen. My son Morgan died 6 years ago. Yet the generosity of people in our community continues to show that suicide is still a very real thing that affects all of us one way or another." Daisy said, "The Ollie Foundation does incredible and valuable work to support young people with their mental health. I'm also incredibly grateful to all those who took part in the White Swans raffle." And there's a picture with the article of the outside of the White Swan, and with three people outside, one handing over a cheque to another.
St Albans MP Daisy Cooper looks back on a week in Westminster, and her article is entitled appalled by the racist abuse hurled at our young England heroes. Like many, I watched the final of the Euros in a local pub. Now, I'm not a die-hard footy fan by any means, but I love the way big sporting events like this bring the country together. And I was so proud of our team. When our three Lions missed three penalties, my first instinct was to give these young players a big hug. Unfortunately, not everyone in the country felt the same. The racist slurs hurled at Sancho, Saka and Rashford were absolutely appalling, but sadly not surprising. This wasn't a one-off incident born of nothing. Earlier in the tournament, the England team took the knee, explaining time and time again that it was an act against racism. But when some spectators chose to boo the team, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson refused to condemn these fans, and Home Secretary Priti Patel openly defended the right to boo whilst dismissing the act of taking the knee as gesture politics. Yet both were swift enough to decry the racial abuse on social media following the final. This utter hypocrisy was best summed up by player Tyrone Mings, who tweeted in response, "You don't get to stoke the fire at the beginning of the tournament by labelling our anti-racism message as gesture politics and then pretend to be disgusted when the very thing we're campaigning against happens." The tone-deaf insults from the Tory camp didn't end there. Another Tory MP retorted to Mings' tweet by telling him to focus on football, not politics, while another berated Marcus Rashford for playing politics and suggested that if he hadn't spent so much time campaigning for free school meals, he might have scored a penalty. They all need to take a long, hard look in the mirror. Quite frankly, if this government has spent more time feeding hungry children, paying nurses a fair wage, and tackling institutional racism, rather than legitimising the hate and abuse thrown at the young England players, the country would be in a better state. And perhaps these three Lions wouldn't have to step in to do their jobs for them.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, July 24th. At 1 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, Lloyd George's Revolution draws on sound archives to tell how Lloyd George revolutionised Britain's government when he became Prime Minister a century ago. On Radio 4 at 2:45, The Etiquette Guide is a new series in which Anne Widdecombe examines how manners, social mores and etiquette have evolved over the millennia. She starts this week with the ancients. 3 p.m, still on Radio 4, the dramatisation of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's 1962 novel One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, the first book to give a true insight into life inside a 1950s Soviet labour camp. Radio 4 at 7:15, Simon Armitage's guest in The Poet Laureate Has Gone to His Shed is author J.K. Rowling. And Radio 3 in concert at 7:30 p.m. is an archive recording by the Budapest Festival Orchestra of Bartok's Hungarian Peasant Songs and Mahler's Fifth Symphony. Don't forget as well, it is the first day of the Olympics in Tokyo 2020, delayed to 2021. They're 8 hours ahead, so all of the action will be from midnight right through to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Coverage will be on Radio 5 Live and Radio 5 Live Sports Extra, and it'll be in news bulletins on other radio stations. But if you want to hear it on the radio, that is the time to hear the live sport right through the next week, starting with the first day's action on that Saturday, July 24th. On to Sunday then, July 25th, and Sunday worship on Radio 4 is at 10 past 8 in the morning. Staying on 4 at 11 a.m, the castaway in Desert Island Discs is nature writer Robert McFarlane. Gardener's Question Time on Radio 4 at 2 comes from Horatio's Garden in South London, includes a tour of the grounds with head gardener Ashley Young. Radio 3 at 6:45 for the Sunday feature Great Scott, which considers why 19th century Scottish literary giant Walter Scott, whose works include Waverley, Ivanhoe and Rob Roy, fell so dramatically out of public favour. Radio 4 at 7.15, Sid is adapted from comedian Arthur Smith's Edinburgh Festival show, which was inspired by the diaries of his father, who fought at Al Alamein, was imprisoned at Colditz after the war, served with the Metropolitan Police. Finally, Radio 4 Extra for Sunday at 8 p.m. Patricia Hodge stars in a dramatisation of Memento Mori, Muriel Spark's comic novel from 1959 about an apparently mundane crime that becomes a metaphysical mystery. On to those programmes now, which are broadcast at the same time every day, Monday to Friday. Same radio station, same time every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. At 9.45 on Radio 4 and repeated at 12:30 each day, the book of the week is Mistresses by Linda Porter, an account of Charles II's love life and the various mistresses by whom he fathered 13 illegitimate children. Radio 3 at 12 noon, the composer of the week is Jennifer Higdon, who was born in 1962 in New York and is one of America's most performed living composers. Just after midday on Radio 4, and repeated each night at 10.45, Still Life is Sarah Winman's story of the unlikely friendship between a British soldier and an alleged spy in wartime Tuscany. Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m, a bit early, repeated at 1 p.m. and 8 p.m, a lot more better times, there's a dramatisation of Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot novel, Mrs. McGinty's Dead. 1.45 on Radio 4 is the Radio Times Pick of the Week, New Storytellers, a series of prize-winning programmes by students of radio production. Back on Radio 4 Extra, 2.15 every day, a book of Middle Eastern food. Claudia Roden is on a quest for Middle Eastern recipes as she explores gatherings where she might meet fellow Middle Easterners. Radio 4, the drama is Passenger List, when the mystery of Flight 702 continues with Season 2 at 2.15 each day this week. And finally, at 7.45 on Radio 4, there's the start of a 25-part series, Incarnations, India in 50 Lives, with profiles of significant figures from Indian history. On to the highlights then for each day of the week, starting with Monday, July 26th. Radio 4, 9 a.m, as part of the series The Patch, the presenter visits Welwyn Garden City, where he discovers the religious order of Focalaire, whose beliefs are based around unity. Radio 4 Extra at 11:50 a.m, just before midday in other words, ballerina Darcy Bustle presents her Inheritance Tracks. Radio 4 at 2, The Why Factor looks at gardens, asking why people are drawn to gardening and hearing the story of a prisoner who created his own garden in Guantanamo Bay. The new series of Brain of Britain continues at 3 on Radio 4, the second of 17 programmes, contestants from London, Middlesbrough and Gloucester. David Mitchell hosts the new series of the panel show The Unbelievable Truth on Radio 4 at 6.30. And finally for Monday, 9 o'clock, still on Radio 4, the first of three programmes, Genetic Dreams, Genetic Nightmares, explores the history of genetic engineering. Tuesday, July 27, 3 p.m, Radio 4, there's the second of six editions of the touring culinary parallel show, The Kitchen Cabinet. 6.30 on Radio 4, as part of the series Simon Evans Goes to Market, The High Street is a light-hearted lecture asking what the future holds for the High Street in the light of the collapse of Debenhams and other big names. Also on 4 at 8 p.m, Black Hill, Bleak Summer looks back at the UK's worst ever foot-and-mouth disease outbreak. On the BBC World Service on digital radio at 8:05, A Tale of Two Tokyos takes a tour of Tokyo and meets some of the people who were impacted by its last Olympic Games in 1964. Peter White presents his regular programme In Touch at 8:40 on Radio 4 with news, views and features for people who are blind or partially sighted. Finally at 9 on Radio 2, The Jazz Show with Jamie Cullum features a special tribute to Louis Armstrong ahead of next week's 120th anniversary of his birth. Wednesday, July 28th, Radio 4 at 9, you can hear the third of four parts of Soul Music, with testimony around the traditional song The Parting Glass, which has become synonymous with leaving, either as a toast at the end of the evening or as a heartfelt farewell to a departed or a deceased person. 11:30, still on Radio 4 on Wednesday morning, in the series What's Funny About, in this week's programme, the subject is Blackadder, P. Peter Fincham and John Plowman talk to John Lloyd and Tony Robinson about the making of Blackadder, discuss the endless problems they had when making the first series, the tensions among the team and the story behind a famous final scene. Radio 3 at 3:30, Choral Evensong comes from Worcester Cathedral and includes the combined cathedral choirs of Worcester, Gloucester and Hereford as part of the 2021 Three Choirs Festival. Finally, still on Radio 3 at 10 p.m, this week's edition of Free Thinking explores shoes from ancient Rome to modern sports shoes, stilettos and the economics of the shoe trade. Thursday, July 29th, 9:30 again start on Radio 4, this week's edition of Metamorphosis, how insects transformed our world, looks at cycles of change. The programme unmasks the mystery of metamorphosis and here's how it's now being used as a barometer to track future climate change. Still on Radio 4 at 11, in Crossing Continents, a year from the explosion that devastated much of Beirut, one of the largest non-nuclear blasts in history, survivors in the district of Carantina, near the port, are trying to rebuild their lives. 2 o'clock on Radio 3, the opera Matinee is a performance of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, recorded earlier this month at a festival in France. Radio 4 Extra at 2:30, A Theatre for Everyman, the story of Liverpool's Everyman Theatre, which has reopened its doors in 2014 following a two-year refurbishment. Radio 4 at 3 for Open Country, when travel writer Ash Barwash revisits his childhood haunts at Windsor Great Park. And at 10:05 on BBC World Service on digital radio, you can hear The Forum. In the evening, a debate on the engineering challenges presented in building the Panama Canal, focusing on the skills of its workers, economic benefits and environmental impact. So to Friday, July 30th, one of the Radio Times choices is Radio 4 Extra at 2:30, Paul is Dead, the story behind a 1969 rumour that the Beatles singer Paul McCartney had died in a car accident and had been replaced by a lookalike orphan from Edinburgh. Radio 4 at 3:45 in the short work series The Counting Sheep by Lucy Caldwell is today's short story. Mary has trouble sleeping until one morning she wakes up to some unexpected visitors. Finally, and no means least, 7:30, Radio 3, the summer highlight for many people, the first night of the proms, broadcast live from the Royal Albert Hall with a programme that celebrates the 150th anniversary of the hall and its 999 pipe organ. It's going to be a cracker. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Here is a selection of audio described television programmes for the week commencing Saturday, the 24th of July 2021. So, starting on that Saturday, the daytime schedule on BBC One is taken over by the Tokyo Olympic Games today and every day this week. But unfortunately, none of it is audio described, but you might understand what is happening from the commentary. Deadly Dinosaurs with Steve Backshaw is on BBC Two at 8:30 a.m, followed by Orbit, Earth's Extraordinary Journey at 9, still on 2, which follows the planet as it journeys around the Sun from January to the March equinox. At 11:30 on BBC Two, A Cook Abroad follows chef Tony Singh around India. Japan with Sue Perkins at 6 p.m. on BBC Two. Sue travels around Japan, starting in Tokyo, where she trains as a sumo wrestler. Coastal Railways with Julie Walters has the actress travelling from Cardigan Bay to Liverpool at 7 p.m. on Channel 4. This is followed by part 4 of A Lake District Farm Shop at 8 p.m, also on 4. This time should they stock goat cheese, and they release a ram into their sheep herd on the family's farm. At 9:30 on BBC Two is Pavarotti in Hyde Park. It's not audio described, but the music will be good. ITV at 10 p.m. has a rerun of The Quiz, a fact-based drama about the alleged cheating during the recording of the TV quiz Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Now on to Sunday, 25th of July. How about starting your Sunday viewing with Happy Feet 2, the sequel to Ants, where Mumble and Eric must rescue their family following a natural disaster? This is on ITV at 2 p.m. At 6 p.m. on BBC Two, Paul Rose completes his journey round the Yorkshire Dales, arriving in Wharfdale, where he meets an original calendar girl. This must have been delayed from last week, as it sounds familiar to me. Tropic of Cancer with Simon Reeve sees Simon travel from the Sahara to Libya. Join Simon on BBC Two at 7 p.m. Also on 2, but at 8 p.m, you can go Inside Monaco, Playground of the Rich, where we see how this extraordinary principality actually works. Also at 8 p.m, but on Channel 4, is the concluding part of A Very British Country House, following life at the exclusive hotel Cliveden House. Lots of choice at 9. Channel 4 has part 6 of A Handmaid's Tale. This week, Vows. BBC One has part 2 of Baptiste, A Tattooed Man is Caught. And on ITV, part 2 of Professor T, A Fish Called Walter, A Librarian is Poisoned at a Drinks Party. Then on Monday, 26th of July, a reminder that all the soaps are audio described, but during the Olympics, EastEnders is being shown at or around 9 p.m. So let's start at 7 p.m. on ITV3, where Downton Abbey continues with episode 6 of series 4. This series is on each night at this time. Then at 8 p.m. on ITV, with James Martin's Islands to Highlands. This week, James takes a culinary journey around Oxford. Also at 8, but on Channel 4, Would You Like to Save a Grand in 24 Hours? The team travel to Blackburn to help a family who have run up a debt of £9,000 during the pandemic. For a third choice at 8, there's the Radio Times Choice of the Day on the Yesterday Channel, Secrets of the London Underground. Siddy and Tim visit a planned station in Hampstead Heath, the tube station that never was. Long Lost Family continues at 9 p.m. on ITV with Paula, who realises her skin is different from her adoptive parents and wants to know more about her birth family. At 10 p.m. on ITV3, there's Series 2, Episode 1 of Unforgotten, with Nicola Walker and Sanjeev Bhaskar. Cassie and Sunny investigate a body found in a suitcase. This series is on every night this week, still at 10, and concluding with 2 episodes on Friday. Tuesday, 27th of July. And Bargain Hunt is on BBC Two at 12:45 p.m. Today, they visit Harrogate. At 7 p.m, Michael Portillo has a great Australian railway journey, starting as he climbs aboard the GAN, the train that runs from Adelaide to Darwin. This series continues tomorrow, going from Sydney to Broken Hill, and Thursday on the Indian Pacific from Adelaide to Perth. At 7:30 p.m. on ITV, Ray Mears continues his Wild China with Ray Mears series. Today, the explorer discovers giant pandas. It's the final of Bake Off the Professionals at 8 on Channel 4. The finalists' first task is to make hats fit for Hollywood, made from chocolate. Or on BBC Two, also at 8, The Secrets of the Museum continues with Epic Iran. some of the largest paintings ever seen at the V&A in an exhibition of the art of Iran. ITV at 9 continues their Cooking with the Stars as the celebrities take on the food of India. Part 4 of Kunk on Britain continues at 10 on BBC Two. Philomena discusses the involvement of the British in the two world wars. Now on to Wednesday, 28th of July. And let's start in Cheshire with Escape to the Country, where a couple is searching for a home. The documentary of the week is on BBC Two at 8 p.m. Chris Packham, The Walk That Made Me. Chris walks from Southampton to Winchester, along some of the oldest waterways in the country, wearing a 360-degree camera. Radio Times calls this programme TV magic. At 9 on Channel 4, George Clark's Remarkable Renovations visits Staffordshire to help a couple with their 19th-century coach house. Or on ITV at 9 p.m, there's a look back at Morecambe and Wise, the lost episode. Eric Morecambe's family find a copy of the duo's first primetime show for the BBC. Thursday, the 29th of July. There's a new series of Yorkshire firefighters starting at 8 p.m. on BBC Two. The fire crews are wondering how lockdown will affect the run-up to Bonfire Night. Also at 8, but on Channel 4, you can wonder, can I improve my memory? Tonight, the semi-finalists must memorise sequential lists. There's A Year on the Beacons on ITV at 8:30 p.m, observing the people who live on the Brecon Beacons through the changing seasons. At 9 on Channel 4, would you like to Escape to the Chateau, Make Do and Mend? Dick Strawbridge and his wife Angel help a couple transform their back garden into an alfresco bathhouse. To close the evening, there's the feature film I Capture the Castle at 10:35 p.m. on BBC Four, a period romantic drama. Cassandra leads a peculiar existence in a ramshackle castle, but the spectre of first love is hovering in the wings. Last but not least, Friday the 30th of July. At 12:45 p.m. on BBC Two, Bargain Hunt sets another antique challenge. Then at 2:45 p.m, let's Escape to the Country, where a couple have a budget of £500,000 to buy a charming Cotswold home. It's the first night of the proms tonight and the Olympics, so three BBC channels are taken over by these events, none of which are audio described, but I'm sure the proms will be in the radio listings. On Channel 4 at 8 p.m, a very British hotel visits the Mandarin Oriental Hyde Park in London. The staff cater for an overseas royal visitor and her entourage, but moving 200 pieces of luggage provides a challenge for the porters. There is Endeavour on ITV at 8:30 p.m. This episode is Quartet. Morse starts an investigation into an assassination attempt at a sporting event, persisting in his inquiries even after the case is considered closed. Another Die Hard film to close the week on ITV at 11:05 p.m. This one is Die Hard with a Vengeance. A deadly game of Simon Says follows a terrorist explosion at a New York department store. I hope you find something of interest in my selection this week.
TNF Soundings.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts ad. An orchid summer. Some things in nature have the power to make enthusiasts, or dare I say geeks, of us all. Ordinarily, the extremes of expressed passion, the odd behaviours and the retelling of obscure discoveries are the reserve of the few, hobbyists and specialists in their field. Such characters have often been portrayed in ways that emphasise their obsessions. Khaki clothing, thick glasses and to all intents and purposes looking like middle-aged Boy Scouts embellished with binoculars or a magnifying glass to highlight their particular focus. Of course, these are all huge generalisations and mostly outdated caricatures, but the truth remains that real enthusiasts are fringe people delving into the detail and experience of nature that most others are either ignorant of or ignore. I am one of those geeks when it comes to birds, and more other flora and fauna too. I'm sure that at times I conform to the caricatures. However, just occasionally, my enthusiasm is shared by all, regardless of their usual everyday nonchalance. Certain species or natural phenomenon have the power to captivate, regardless of former devotions. Sunsets and sunrises, of course, but also barn owls, kingfishers, and otters. Something about their inherent beauty, movement, or appearance has the potency to transform even the dullest critic into an avid enthusiast, willing to embrace momentarily a childlike excitement and abandon in place of usual social norms. This past month, I have encountered one of those powerful draws of nature, this time in the plant kingdom. Whatever the weather has done this spring, it seems to have benefited those most beautiful of plants, the orchids. Always rare and much sought after by orchid hunters, orchids have throughout history drawn admirers from all walks of life. Part of their intrigue comes simply from their rarity, but also because they are genuinely unusual flowers, mimicking the shape of bees, insects, monkeys and even man in their attempts to attract pollinators. At Tittenhanger gravel pits on the edge of St Albans, I discovered my first ever bee orchids this year, and have had the chance to marvel close up at their intricacy. I hesitated to share the news, but thankfully bee orchids are one of the more widespread orchids, and Tittenhanger can boast more than 60 plants this year. Though tiny plants, they have drawn many visitors who may be seen staring intently at grassy banks, crouching down and pointing, or even lying down for the perfect bee orchid photograph. Aside from their beauty and rarity, orchids add to their aura of excitement by popping up in the most unexpected of places. A lawn that has been left uncut, a roadside verge, including this year the far from salubrious setting of Bulldog Service Station. One young naturalist hit orchid gold just recently as he walked an area of rough ground in St Albans. 8-year-old Caspar Lee Motzko, who is familiar with many of the plants in his local area, noticed an unusual orchid growing and contacted Hearts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust to share his discovery. The single plant turned out to be the extremely rare lizard orchid, so named for its petals' resemblance to the long, thin body shape of lizards. Ian Denholm, the county botanical recorder for Hearts and national orchid referee for the Botanical Society of Britain and Ireland, commented, "The lizard orchid is one of our most spectacular native orchids and is a very significant find in Hearts. There are long-standing colonies in Kent, Sussex, Cambridgeshire and Somerset. Elsewhere in the UK, it is rare and greatly sought after by orchid enthusiasts. One turned up in 2020 in a private wildflower lawn at Browing in Hearts. Before that, there is just a single Hearts record from the 1930s. Caspar must be congratulated for his sharp eyes, but his find's location must also remain top secret. A study published in 1999 revealed that the main contributor to the lizard orchid's rarity was down to plant collecting, with plants being dug up for private collections or simply to be transplanted in private gardens. Orchids are one of the wonders of nature, with the power to pull a crowd, so if you come across them, please take only a photograph and think twice before sharing their location.
Hi, this is an article from Hearts Life magazine called Ancient Highway. And it's about the Great North Road, cycled in this case by Steve Silk, a BBC journalist. He says it was traversed by royals, rebels, traders and highwaymen. And it was once the backbone of Britain. When the great American essayist Ralph Waldo Emerson coined the phrase Life is a journey, not a destination. He probably wasn't thinking of the A1. But what is today's monotonous motorway up much the length of Britain? It was once, more or less, the route of the infinitely more romantic Great North Road. To mark the centenary of the numbering of roads in Britain by the newly formed Ministry of Transport, that's 100 years ago, thereby erasing, on paper at least, the Great North Road, BBC journalist and author Steve Silk went on a mission to cycle the original 400-mile route from London to Edinburgh, including through Hertfordshire's historic coaching stops. He says, "I was basically on a pilgrimage to try and seek out the glory days of the Great North Road, the days when mail coaches raced northwards, changed horses in strategically placed inns along the way. I do love the fact that even today, counties have their own characteristics. Hertfordshire, seen from the modern A1M, appears lush and green with barely a building to be seen. Hertfordshire's rivers drain south into the Thames Basin, but once you climb up to Bedfordshire, they drain the other way into the Wash. A fun fact, as my daughters would say." Being a home county's boy, Steve thought he knew Hertfordshire pretty well, but soon discovered he really didn't as he aimed his Jamis Aurora bike north of London. As a southerner, travelling north, I knew I had to be on my guard for the first few days. There's a danger that you only start to really pay attention once things look and feel different. Everything from the accent to the attitude and the architecture. But in reality, I felt that Hertfordshire did have its own character, and that this old road heading all the way up to Edinburgh might just have contributed to it. Hertfordshire still has bucket loads of character despite its proximity to London. Take Baldock, for example, another town to prosper in the coaching era. It's still easy to spot what they call carriage arches, surviving within both pubs and private houses. One particular Hertfordshire pub stands out for Steve, however, the Eight Bells in Old Hatfield. It was the inn Bill Sykes, bullseye in tow, fled to following his murder of Nancy in Oliver Twist. Charles Dickens was a visitor to the pub, and the charismatic watering hole couldn't escape Steve's notice. There are some pubs which I find impossible to pass by, and the Eight Bells was one of them. It's a whitewashed building that seems to have become embedded in the landscape over the years. I had my swift half sitting at a window where I was level with pedestrians' feet. He adds that the Great North Road once ran straight through the grounds of nearby stately home Hatfield House. It wasn't until the 19th century that the Marquess of Salisbury bought himself a bit more privacy by moving the Great North Road westwards with the help of a canny three-way deal with the old Turnpike Trust and the new Great Northern Railway. That track still exists, and I cheekily asked if the house would open the gates especially for me, in the interests of historical authenticity, of course. They were very polite, and even offered me a complimentary ticket. It did mean I could explore Hatfield House itself, and what a treasure it is. Alongside Hatfield, Old Wellin stood out for Steve on his bike ride. The reason I loved Wellin is that it's one of those timeless high streets where I find it's remarkably easy to imagine a time when the coach was the king of the road. The hooves clattering and the guard blowing his horn. I didn't have the space to explore this feature in the book, but I absolutely love the fact that Wellin had the barefaced cheek to build a museum directly underneath the modern A1. It's dedicated to some important Roman remains found in the vicinity, and it's well worth a visit. Another place that warrants a visit in the village, Steve said, is the Wellington. Dating back to the 14th century, it counts both of Britain's favourite Samuels among its distinguished guests. Dr. Samuel Johnson was a regular, while the diarist Samuel Pepys said that of all the nights that ever I slept in my life, I never did pass a night more epicurism of sleep. High praise indeed. I'm not entirely sure what it means. Of course, another visitor that actually Steve doesn't mention was Vincent van Gogh, who was in England for some time, and he came to visit his sister, who was in Wellin. And Vincent himself had walked, I believe, all the way from Canterbury, where he was staying for a time. Following old maps and archive material along a route that has shaped the nation through centuries of travel, Steve became enamoured with the old road. I was in the very unusual position of being able to do whatever I wanted without consequence. This is not a Land's End to John O'Groats race. It's a journey. A journey to be savoured. And the journey has had a lasting impact on him. And his book, The Great North Road, London to Edinburgh, 11 Days, Two Wheels, and One Ancient Highway, has been out since July the 8th, at a price of $9.99.
Hello, my name's Sue, and this story is called Poet's Corner. Looking for a way to spread positivity in lockdown, the owner of a special garden near Wheat Hampstead began pinning poems to her fence. It was the start of a collaboration with walkers. A little lane, the brook runs close beside, and spangles in the sunshine, while fish glide swiftly by, and hedges leafing with the green spring tide. This lovely verse from On a Lane in Spring, by the 19th century poet John Clare, known for his celebrations of the English countryside, has always been a favourite of Sarah Jane Nalkane. When COVID made an unwelcome entrance and we went into lockdown last March, Sarah Jane wanted to lift the people's spirits during their daily walk. So she put up poems on the fence by a public footpath that runs by her garden and home near Wheat Hampstead. "I've always liked poetry," explains Sarah Jane, "and like everyone else, I was trying to adapt to the news of the COVID pandemic and a change of lifestyle as we all began the first lockdown. I was trying to get my family back home. My daughter was at university in Edinburgh and feeling quite down from all the lifestyle changes that were drastically happening around us. Reading poetry helped me feel calm, and I thought it would be a good idea to share my favourite poems with people walking by the house. Water End House sits on the side of a hill not far from a small bridge that crosses the River Lee. The elegant Jacobean manor was built in 1610 by Sir John Jennings. The four-acre garden was quite formal, with plenty of mature trees and yew hedges, when Sarah Jane and her husband James moved here in 1999, but they soon started to clear areas to open up views of the river and the Hertfordshire landscape. The footpath running by the garden has a wooden fence, where poems were pinned, and Sarah Jane also left a notebook and a pen to encourage passers-by to comment. "I never really thought that there would be a big response," she says, "but I hoped the poems would make people stop and reflect on nicer things rather than all the bad news that surrounded us." The comments book soon started to fill up, however, including those walkers had suggested. She also emailed photos of the poems to those shielding at home. Later in the year, when shielding restrictions had finished, some of those people came and looked at the poems for themselves, and it was a delight to see, says Sarah Jane. It also gave the opportunity for a socially distanced chat over the garden fence. The fence of poetry continued through the summer as restrictions were lifted and more poems were added to the display, with suggestions from passers-by, including poetry in different languages, and many were inspired to write their own. Gardens weren't open for a while, and along with a chance to immerse themselves in poems, people enjoyed their country walks and glimpses of the garden, flowers, and wildlife from the footpath, says Sarah Jane. The fence of poetry remains today and is continuously updated. Sarah Jane is looking forward to opening her garden once again. Groups of 20 can book appointments until October. The garden at Water End House was first opened for the National Garden Scheme in 2018 for the Snowdrop Festival, and more than 800 people visited the first weekend. The garden opened again in September the following year for autumn colour from trees, foliage and borders, and was again popular with visitors. The garden opened this year in June and offered many flowering displays in the borders at the height of the gardening year, including roses, peonies, irises and herbaceous perennials. "We have traditional long English country garden herbaceous borders," explained Sarah Jane, "and there are other areas with different planting themes, flint gardening walls, a vegetable garden, an orchard with old apple and pear trees, ponds and water features, and a formal garden area in front of the house with classic lines of yew hedges. If you'd like to visit the garden at Water End House, email Sarah Jane to arrange a date for a group or a bespoke visit at sj at Nalcain, that's NALLCAIN.com.
We now have the third in the series of items warning of scams, recorded by HCC Trading Standards Officer Darren Ward. This one concerns energy-saving scams.
We at Trading Standards deal with many scams, including products and services that claim to improve the energy efficiency of your property. In an age where this is becoming really important to people who are concerned with their day-to-day impact on the environment, becoming a victim of a scam where what's promised turns out to be a lie can end up not only being very costly, but can also leave you with a lot of home improvements that turn out to be worthless. Environmentally friendly products such as solar panels, cavity wall insulation, loft insulation, and double glazing can be a legitimate way to reduce your impact on the environment and, in the long term, can even save you money. However, how can you, as a consumer, tell the difference between a service being provided by a genuine trader as opposed to one being provided by rogues? There's a few questions you need to ask yourself. Were you contacted out of the blue by the company? This is always the biggest red flag. Does the deal sound too good to be true? Are you being promised a grant to pay for the work? Are you under pressure to respond quickly? Is there a surveyor who just happens to be in your area? Is this a one-day-only offer promising a big percentage reduction on the usual price? Are you being told about changes in environmental law that mean you must make changes to your existing product? So fire switches for solar panels, or that fiberglass insulation is now illegal? Are the price details vague? Is the company unwilling or unable to give you a general price up front before they visit? Is the trader out of area? If so, how easy do you think it'll be to get them back if there's a problem? Can you spot any spelling or grammatical mistakes in the leaflet, email or text? Or are you being asked to keep it quiet and not discuss the matter with friends and family? If you've answered yes to any of these, there's a really good chance it's a scam. You need to steer clear and do not allow them to visit. We've seen a recent rise in complaints from homeowners who already have solar panels. Reports have been of a phone call out of the blue telling the resident that the company that has installed their panels has gone bust, but that they, the caller, have taken over the warranty work. However, this usually means that they have bought the customer list and will be contacting everyone on it to try and sell them something that they don't need. Bogus companies have told residents things like your inverter needs changing, when they've got absolutely no evidence that it does. Or, we've been monitoring your panels. There's no way they can do any such thing. Or that your fire switch replacement is required due to a change in the law. Again, this is untrue. As a result, homeowners have paid for unnecessary and expensive work. Don't be panicked into agreeing to get any work done as a result of a cold call from someone you don't know. Instead, get a second opinion from a trustworthy trader. Then shop around for the best deal for you. If you do sign up, remember you've got a right to 14-day cooling-off period for any contracts agreed at your home. Be aware, though, that this cooling-off period doesn't apply to bespoke goods such as double glazing, so check exactly what, if any, cooling-off period is being offered in those circumstances. This next part is really important. Don't be persuaded to allow the work to start early by signing the paperwork. Always read what you're being asked to sign and don't sign if you're not happy. The cooling off period is a time for you to do your research or speak to family and friends, and you can cancel without penalty if needs be. If you have signed, you can still cancel until the service is concluded, but you will have to pay reasonable costs up to the point of the cancellation. We know this sounds complicated, but it need not be, so long as you do your research up front. You find a good trader, and you're not rushed into making a bad decision. So, before you agree to a visit from a solar panel company, consider the following. What do you actually need solar panels to do? Is it just to provide the electricity you need, or to sell any excess off to the national grid? Get several quotes from different companies. Compare the prices and what's included, and make sure you get a written breakdown of how any claimed energy savings can add up. If the price seems lower than any other quotes, check whether all the services are included. But beware for one-off or on-the-spot discounts, which are examples of pressure selling. Decide what your budget is and stick to it. Remember that this is a long-term investment, and you'll probably not recoup any savings for at least 15 years, maybe more. If finance is offered, shop around for it. You don't have to take the deal that's offered to you by the solar panel company. Be clear about the costings and get the best deal for you. If you use a credit card to pay for part of the price, even if it's just a deposit, you'll have extra protection from your bank in case things go wrong. Look at the length of the warranty being offered. You should expect 25 to 30 years for the solar panels and 5 to 10 years for the inverter, because the inverter is the most likely part to break down. Look at whether they're a member of a trustworthy trade association. The Home Insulation and Energy Systems Quality Assurance Contractors Scheme is the big one. If you're interested in installing any of these energy efficient products, ask your family and friends if they have any personal recommendations, or use a trusted trader scheme. Please remember, though, not all trusted trader schemes carry out the same level of checks, and reviews may not always tell the full story. Take care to double check the scheme you want to use, and if there is one, use your local Trading Standards approved trader scheme. For advice, or to ask for support from Trading Standards, call the Citizens Advice Consumer Helpline on 0808 223 1133. Thank you for listening.
We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Bob, Sarah, Caroline, Elaine and Sue. And of course, John Cushing for the radio listings, John Barker for the audio described TV listings, and Rupert Evershed for Nature Notes. Next week, Steve will be here with News Extra, but that's all from me in July 2021. We close with Jeremy North playing Summer Rain. I do hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now, and stay safe.